Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
There is a democratization of campaign finance that's underway that we don't fully understand. Yes. And my great hope at the moment, my optimism for ineffective incumbents being challenged within their own party is that they're is more awareness than there's ever been. This is one of the silver linings of the Trump era. More people are paying attention to what's going on in Washington. More people care.
As Sagar and I are very well aware, y'all's favorite topic is political reform, third parties, campaign finance. No matter what we do, everyone keeps coming back. So we're having another episode about the topic. We have an awesome guest, Weston Womp. Weston is a senior strategist at Issue One and the host of the Swamp Stories podcast, which was a great listen. I definitely recommend you all check it out. And he's bringing an interesting perspective to the debate over political reform in this country. Weston, as he will say, is firmly on the right. He primaried an incumbent congressman in 2014. He's from 2017. Since then, he's pursued a career as a venture capitalist, but has remained incredibly focused on the issue of dark money in politics, and is also dedicated to focusing on the issue of the national debt at the Millennial Debt Foundation, a 501c3 that he runs. I love this conversation because we get into the topics of how Washington actually works, but we also had a fairly spirited debate about the nature of the national debt and whether or not it's a threat or not. Sagar and I are pretty outspoken on our skepticism of a lot of the folks who focus on the national debt as an issue, especially during a pandemic, but it was good to have someone on who could have a good faith articulation of why it matters during the conversation.
Yeah, we hear from you guys. We know that's one of the things that you want to hear us pushed back on, so we wanted to give you that opportunity. I really enjoy talking with Weston because he's somebody who's just not full of it. He's not a hypocrite. I mean, we were talking about corruption, and I was like, yeah, I mean, Republicans like to talk about Biden's corruption, but we literally, you know, sat by for 4 years while the president literally owned a hotel in town, which people who wanted to curry his favor stayed at, which is probably not great if you're going to have some credibility on that issue. And he was like, yeah, that's terrible. So I just think that having somebody who's even willing to say those words is the only way we can have an honest conversation about any of this. Okay, so you guys know the drill. Make sure you subscribe to our Substack, therealignment.substack.com, our weekly newsletter with transcripts and more. As you all saw, we had our little Clubhouse invite contest. We gave out 10 different invitations to Clubhouse, something we've been talking about and spending some time on the app, and very excited to say that all of those invites have gone out. So congratulations to the winners. Also, if you could help us out, we're having a little bit of a problem with a few trolls who've decided to tank our pristine 5-star review to 4.9. Their gripe is that we supposedly cut Balaji Srinivasan off unfairly. Now, as we've explained to all of you who listen to this podcast, we had a time constraint literally right up until that, and we literally had to go because Marshall and I both have day jobs, and we had a previously scheduled meeting. If we had the time, this was our full-time job, I could have sat there and listened to the guy for 3.5 hours. Unfortunately, that is not the world that we live in right now. So if you can help us out, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, help us bump right back up to 5 stars. Also, it's just a great way to be able to ask a question to Marshall and I in your review, and it helps other people find the show. With that, let's get to the question and answer period.
A quick reminder, the way you can get your question in is you can leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Either leave the question in your review, or you could send us an email at realignmentpod@gmail.com, or leave it in a comment on the Substack. Today's question comes from Tito Rican. Hey guys, love the show. So today, in the midst of the devastation caused by the cold in Texas, I'd like to ask this. It seems to be the perfect example of propaganda and partisan nonsense. Both sides immediately blamed the other for what happened. And what this does, as usual, is perpetuate the hate and anger that does nothing to solve any of our problems. Both sides are comfortable blaming the other, benefiting politically and financially, while leaving the status quo as it is. The right says it's the fault of depending too much on wind turbines and new sources of energy that just don't work as well as the old standbys. The left says that it's the fault of regulation and greed that keeps these companies from really providing a modern and dependable source of energy. Is one side right? Is both sides right? Which is it? Most of us have lives that don't afford us the ability to delve into research all day and come to a well-thought-out conclusion, so we count to you as our news source, and the cycle continues.
Thank you for the question, Tito Rican. Look, you're lucky, because Marshall and I literally talked about this on Rising during one of our panels. Here's the deal. The solution is not politically convenient, because it turns out the Texas governor's office definitely did ignore some warnings about once-in-100-year storms. Now, it's not wind power. Wind power only accounts for like 10% of the amount of energy in all of Texas. So actually, the solution that comes away from all of this is not going to please anyone, which is winterize your natural gas pipelines and fittings. That's it. It's actually quite simple. The problem that the right and left have is that doesn't mean let's frack more and let's have more oil and natural gas. And the left is like, no, this isn't to show an affirmative case for the Green New Deal either. So there you go. It's not politically convenient, but it actually just comes down to common sense. What do you think, Marshall?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a perfect example of the problem of the nationalization of politics, which is rather than focus on your own local screw-up or the fact that life is complicated, leading to actual death and really serious destruction, people decided to make this about the Green New Deal and the AOC boogeywoman. Yep. Look, there's a case to be had against the Green New Deal. We've aired it on this podcast. This is not it. As someone said on Twitter, hey, you know there are windmills in Norway. So it seems that there's probably something else going on here. So a reminder, as always, despite all the incentives, despite the intentions of others, don't try to make everything about national politics. Sometimes there actually are straightforward technocratic things that we can do to actually make things better, especially at the local level.
Exactly. All right. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate the work that they let us do here. Let's get to the show.
Weston Wamp, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks, guys. Honored to be here.
Good to see you, Weston.
So your podcast, Swamp Stories, covers pretty much every single topic that our listeners are always pinging us for not talking enough about. Corruption in D.C., debates over gerrymandering, campaign finance, all that type of stuff. But I was listening to an episode to prep for the show, and when you had Mike Gallagher on, who's great, we've had him on the podcast, he's a congressman from Wisconsin, he made the point that the one area of cross-partisan agreement in this country is basically the idea that Washington doesn't work and is fundamentally broken to some level. That's a simple statement to agree about. Where this becomes more complicated is where we start actually articulating what that problem is, what's broken, how to fix it. So let's just start here. What is your articulation of the problem in Washington and what exactly the issue is?
Man, well, in some ways, this feels like my life's work. So loaded question. I grew up around this stuff. My dad served in Congress for a period of time, most of my childhood. He served for 16 years and was sort of a contrarian Bible Belt conservative in that he worked on what we call now political reform, or some folks may call democracy reform. Back in the day, some aspects of it may have been campaign finance reform. I think, you know, people interact more than ever with the campaign side of what goes on in Washington. And then the real business of Washington is less interesting outside of a pandemic. And a pandemic, you know, the machinations of Washington might actually have some immediate effects on life, because you might end up with a direct deposit in your account. But, you know, if you look sort of over a continuum, I mean, most people's interaction is during campaign season. They have some understanding of the way campaigns work. And I think increasingly on both sides of the aisle in Washington, these issues are different. But across the country, to your point, there is almost universal sentiment that money runs the show. And it buys access on both sides of the aisle. And there's a cabal in Washington. And it, in effect, doesn't matter who's in charge. Those with resources will buy their way to the front of the line. And they've begun to see, I think, the onset of the super PAC era. It's very misunderstood. I think even the uses of super PACs are not what we thought they were or would be a decade ago. But nonetheless, mm-hmm. These are things that have brought Citizens United and Supreme Court rulings and First Amendment questions and campaign finance questions back to the forefront. And I think there's generally an accepted agreement across party lines among regular Americans. And I live in Tennessee, raising three kids with a fourth on the way. So I feel like I've got some, you know, connection to the regular world and detachment from Washington enough to realize there's a gross lack of confidence, and they think that members of Congress are on the take. And whether that's literally the case, in some ways doesn't matter, because that's the perception. And of course, as you guys know, it's an onion you got to peel back to really get to the corruption or perception of corruption, which our founders, by the way, were just about as worried about the perception of corruption as they were corruption itself.
I completely agree with you there, Weston. And part of the problem, though, and this is what we should get into, which is that a lot of the discussion is almost always directed one way and not inwardly. So, for example, like, you know, you have all these Republicans who are like, Biden Inc., you know, like his brother signed this, like, shady. And look, it's true. Like, it's shady as hell. Same thing with Hunter Biden and all of that. But we also just went through 4 years where the president of the United States owned a hotel where, like, foreign diplomats were staying, right? Like, so I think to have an honest conversation about this, we have to say, what is the state of the swamp after 4 years of Trump? And from my perspective, what it is all Trump did was he ran against the traditional swamp and then empowered parts of the traditional ones who were willing to agree with him, but also created kind of his own, like, much more low IQ swamp. So, like, instead of, you know, the traditional lobbyists getting paid $50,000 a month, it was like Corey Lewandowski. Or like instead of. I'm not going to name any law firms so they don't sue me, but like there are these law firms that are all on the take. And then like now it's like Corey Lewandowski is getting $50,000 a month from the Qatari government, or, you know, David Bossie, or any of these other like traditional characters. So, I mean, as somebody who, you know, you're a conservative guy, but like how do you think we should discuss and acknowledge this swamp after 4 years under Trump if we want to actually do something about it, which I do?
Yeah, well, that's you framed all of that the right way. I'll tell you, this is a preface, and it makes me a unicorn in the work that I do. I think, you know, it's a disorienting time to be political, but I think I am very conservative, just in terms of disclosure here. I mean, again, grew up in Tennessee, son of a Republican congressman, cut my teeth in politics, almost got elected in my 20s myself. I am categorically very conservative. I also, I guess, just had a front row seat most of my childhood and adolescent years to how Washington really works. And so I'm cynical and a bit of a contrarian. And I, a lot of times, am not all that concerned with what the opposing party, in my case, the Democratic Party, is up to, because I'm more concerned. I take more personally, you know, the consistency and the principle of my party. So to your point, it obviously rings hollow, and we'll get to debt issues, which are the other ones that I work on. But between reform issues and debt issues, oftentimes it's hard to even get past the obvious partisan hyperbole and then partisan hypocrisy. Because in your case, you need, a lot of Republicans want to talk about Hunter Biden. They don't want to talk about the emoluments clause. They don't want to talk about the kind of obvious conflicts that have existed over the last 4 years. I don't think the swamp, I would not know how to define that the swamp improved over the last 4 years. So the drain the swamp, I think what's fascinating is the drain the swamp mantra speaks to the heart of the American people and this concern, this gut feel. Voters aren't stupid. I've experienced this firsthand. Voters aren't stupid. They sense that this is out of whack. They might not be able to explain exactly the effect that a leadership can have, you know, if it's used perversely or whatever the, you know, the micro issue might be. But they feel things are messed up. Drain the swamp sold. A lot of guys like Congressman Mike Gallagher in Wisconsin tried to put meat on the bone in terms of what it looks like to drain the swamp. And it never got really any bipartisan support.
And this is a deeper question I want to ask you, because I don't have a compelling answer to this. We can discuss all the ways that DC is corrupt today. We can discuss all the different ways that the Democratic Party or the Republican Party are rigged in the elections and all that sort of stuff. On a historical basis, though, and you would know this, you know, as the son of a congressman, this is probably one of the least corrupt moments in American politics, in the sense you read about the 1950s and the 1960s. You read about literal, like, not just like dark money, but there were no actual contribution limits at all whatsoever. You read about how local political gangs would literally rig elections in ways that make any of the, even the accusations in 2020 look like child's play. So how do we deal with the fact that we had an era in American politics that was incredibly corrupt, yet it seems as if things actually worked during that system? So the same period where we sent to put a man on the moon, the period when we built the interstate highway system, won World War II, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was a corrupt system, but it worked. But today we have a corrupt system, or there's the perception of a corrupt system that doesn't work. So can you just help us try to think through that idea? Because that's what I'm just more concerned about, because I feel as if there's something deeper going on than the fact that there are super PACs spending money, because people have always spent money, and they've spent money in ways I think are much more straightforwardly bad. So just help us think about that.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to get into this super PAC question, because again, it is so different than the original concerns. And even their use in the 2020 cycle was distinctly different than it has been in the prior four cycles since Citizens United. So that's something we ought to touch before we're done. I think you're right when you describe corruption in yesteryear being worse than it is today. I would even argue there's probably more definitive corruption at the state level. You know, I'm always fascinated. Like my state of Tennessee is a pretty darn well-run state by almost any account, one of the most fiscally sound states in the country. But I'm fascinated as even friends of mine, you know, state senators put together a $35+ billion budget every year, just how quickly decisions can be made and massive amounts of resources can be allocated. Whereas in Washington, you know, if the three of us decided, all right, we're going to go really advocate a specific piece of legislation, we may very well be able to pull it off in the next decade, right? But if in all seriousness, if I wanted to do that in Tennessee, I might be able to get it done if it made sense in the before session is over in May. So I think you're right. And that's why I would say we use the word corruption in some of the promotional materials for the podcast. I would define Washington and the process by which people go about getting elected and reelected to offices in Washington. I'd define it as screwed up more than I would corrupt, truthfully. Now, this real sophisticated language from your Tennessee guest. But and that's what we can unpack. I think more than anything, it's become, some people will say rigged. I do think we've damn near created a situation where incumbency is rigged, and the protection of incumbency is a real thing that Washington has protected. You know, there's been, I think, an intentional effort over some time to make it almost certain that incumbents will get reelected. You know, incumbents in primaries virtually never lose. And then, you know, we know that most districts are safe. But I think there's more nuance to it. And it's that there's a system now that has poor incentives across the board. And there are really strange, and I think there's almost oddities, because they don't even appear like conflicts maybe to the average person. And then as you explain some of the practices that are just commonplace on the Hill, you realize, man, this has all become very perverse in the way that members of Congress, even down to the way that they live, right? They have no expense budget. So a lot of members of Congress are living in their offices. There's just dysfunction in and out of the system.
Yeah, it's so interesting, because I've also thought a lot about this question, because to Marshall's point, I mean, like, all you have to go is go read Means of Assent, the second biography on LBJ. Like, they literally stole an election, like cash for votes, like that votes that didn't exist. Like, it makes Dominion conspiracy theories look like tame in compared to what actually happened in real life. But it's arguable that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, whenever it was dominant, was much more actual answerable to people's concerns in terms of the machines that were produced. So my theory on this is that, yes, the machines and the politicians then would rig, quote unquote, the elections, or were outright bought by many others, but they had a sense in their heads, or at least the machines themselves had some sort of ability to have pushback, like actual small d democracy pushback. Like, they felt more in touch with their constituents, and that because of just how our economic system is structured, because of the way that power is distributed culturally and more, that is actually what's changed. That it's much more of a story about the elites than it is, and who they feel beholden to, and who they think will check will come from, than necessarily on whether it's the actual physical distribution of cash, as in like with the briefcase themselves. So that's kind of the way I think about it. But one of the things that you said, which I think is important, which is the conflagration of inputs, is what has ultimately created the system where everybody's pissed off. So let's talk about, what are those inputs that we're talking about. So like you talked about there, something small like expense budgets. Yeah, it is really weird that a lot of politicians literally sleep in their office, which is why they always can't wait to get the hell out of town and go home. Because they want to stay here for like 48 hours. The jet fumes all come up around D.C. What are some of those inputs that you think need reform, which might have a beneficial impact on the system?
Well, let me give you some real specific ones. You may think and your listeners may think, well, that's not going to change American democracy for the better. But I'd say we are more than ever at a point where iterative bipartisan reforms would probably go a long way. So an example, because I mentioned an expense budget.
Yeah.
So leadership PACs were created almost by accident 40 years ago or so. We did an episode early when we launched Swamp Stories on this. And we got Henry Waxman, the California Democrat, who incidentally created them. And we on the podcast, we're explaining to him what's happening, and he had no idea. And he calls for it all to be reformed as we're talking to him. But this is a patent bipartisan issue. And it's fascinating to me because I've seen the way that it works in the lives of members of Congress, both friends of mine, friends of our family, and my dad's colleagues, you know, just kind of a lifetime around it. You know, congressional pay has been stagnated at $174,000 a year for over a decade. It's not a ton of money if you live in New York. It's a pretty good living if you live in Tennessee. A lot of members of Congress have more financial issues than you might realize. And within that $174,000, they're paying for a second place to live in Washington. You guys know Washington's not cheap.
Yes.
And there are real pinches in the lives of members of Congress. So you've got two accounts that almost all members of Congress now maintain: their campaign account, which is heavily regulated. And if you misuse funds out of it, like Duncan Hunter or like Jesse Jackson Jr., you could either go to prison or need a presidential pardon to avoid it. Because there are real laws, and DOJ is proven willing to come after you for misuse of campaign funds. Well, what's crazy is that with even higher limits in terms of how much can be given, leadership PACs are this loophole, effectively, if you will, that exists to allow members of Congress to take money. And it tends to be this money comes primarily from PACs, not individual donors. So they'll take $5,000 from Boeing's PAC or name it, right? And name the, you can always connect the dots between the committees that the members serve on. And this every 2 year, $5,000 donation that they take into their leadership PAC. Well, there are no, this is crazy. And a lot of people don't realize it. There are no statutes whatsoever governing what leadership PAC money is used for. And so we call them slush funds because I'm not going to out anybody. But you got to, you know, this is also in many cases has been published, and it happens on both sides of the aisle. People will take their family on lavish vacations. You know, there's a lot of members of Congress who feel safe in their incumbency. They'll go eat steak dinners multiple times a week because there is not, even if, you know, I think there's kind of universal agreement that this is not particularly ethical, no statutes by which anybody would come after them. So I think it's one of the, but I also see, in some ways, a connection that is that I think a lot of Americans would call potentially corrupt, because you do have such regular corporate givers that fund an account that's basically just a slush fund. Now, the leadership PACs were set up, by the way, so that members of Congress could give like-minded members of Congress or other politicians campaign donations without it coming from their campaign account. But today, the vast majority in any Congress, the vast majority of expenditures out of these leadership PACs are not to other campaigns at all. They're on fundraising expenses or steak dinners or vacations. And so, like, it's just an example of one of the weird inputs. It's not, you know, it's not probably the biggest one. It's not the single greatest fix we could make, but it's just an example of how polluted it's become.
So this is what I'm wondering here, though. What outcomes that are negative that your average American who's looking at the system and then saying this is bad comes from this quote unquote, to use your phrase, this screwed up in this part, right? Because from my perspective, when we take on the persona of a leftist listener to the show, they would say something like, exactly, because we have these leadership PACs and all these different types of funding, you can't pass the Green New Deal because corporate America buys all these Republicans. I, however, don't believe that's true. I think the reason why Republicans don't go along with climate change legislation has probably nothing to do with money. Maybe there's stuff at the margins, but that's actually a culture war issue, which has sort of come there. Like the reason why Republicans are pro-life has nothing to do with giving. Amazon could put all the money at once into leadership PACs, and you wouldn't have the Republican Party's representatives taking a different stand and perspective there. So when we're actually talking about policy outcomes, what are ways or what are examples of these leadership PACs actually driving outcomes or situations that we wouldn't like?
Yeah, well, you know, so this is a, you may think this is an unusual answer, but Congress has become so dysfunctional in recent years that as the rise of super PACs has really gotten out of control, you've had very little happen in the Congress that would even be traceable. I think you're right, though. I mean, this, you know, the right place to look for quid pro quo would not be on a culture war issue. You know, you're not going to, I've talked to Dan Crenshaw about this a lot. You know, you're not going to convince Dan Crenshaw to be, you know, in support of, you know, the oil industry because he's given money. He's going to be in support of the oil industry because it's where so many of his constituents derive their good living, right? I mean, so there's a there's a pragmatism here. And I mean, you know, to your point, Marshall, there's no question that, and I have a lot of fun with my friends on both sides of the aisle here. Corporate America buys access on both sides equally, and they're very careful to do it equally. And, you know, the big banks, I remember one of my best friends telling me, oh, the big banks, they fund all the Republicans. Well, the banks actually are very careful to fund the Republicans and the Democrats literally equally, you know. And so, I think where you would look, though, is you'd look to the committees where you know who's got influence based on their jurisdiction. And you will see, and I just think when you're talking about a budget that ends up being, because in the life of many members of Congress, this leadership PAC budget is a way to go from effective income, $174,000 gross, to you're adding, you know, kind of $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year of kind of, you know, net income to your family ability to buy food and entertainment, et cetera. That's a real thing, guys. That's not a one-off. There's not three or four members of Congress, you know, members of Congress that are doing that. There's hundreds. And I think what you'll see is they know, and members of Congress know which corporate PACs are the most reliable, which ones will give without asking. And when they're giving both to the campaign side and to this leadership PAC side, I'm one of the only people I think who's ever kind of detailed, might there be a conflict here? You know, when you've got money not going to a campaign, you know, a campaign account's been taking money from multiple sources throughout American history. But the fact that we've got this little side account that now the, you know, the two-thirds of members of Congress, you know, members of Congress are using, well, that's a whole, that introduces a whole new litany of potential conflicts. And I think, you know, related to that, I don't think most Americans know that in their state capital, certainly in my case in Tennessee, in Nashville, lobbying is much more tightly regulated in state capitals in most cases than it is in DC. And that's where, you know, another episode we did that I think is equally interesting and compelling on the left and the right side of the aisle is an episode we did on shadow lobbying. In the Obama administration, they made huge headlines and a lot of people thought we'd made this, you know, massive improvement in American policy by banning lobbyists from coming into the Obama administration. And it led to over 8 years from 2017 until 2016, I mean, 2007 to 2016, you had a reduction from 15,000 to 10,000 lobbyists. And there's a lot of people celebrating, oh, there's fewer lobbyists than there've ever been. Well, what happened is that they had created an incentive for Democratic lobbyists to go dark and to stay under that 20% threshold. Because if you stay under, you know, 20% of your time for a client being lobbying, then you don't have to register as a lobbyist. So I think that then there's people, whether you're a climate change advocate or whether you're worried about the long-term fiscal future of the country as I am, now you don't even know who's lobbying the government because we've put incentives in place, not paying attention to what we're doing, that actually cause and incent people to go dark on the system.
So this is, you know, what we're talking again is about the incentives that cause politicians to behave in a way that may produce adverse effects. So let's actually like go down the line here, like term limits. This is one where I think a lot of people like to have discussion. I'm actually curious what you think, given your own father's long tenure within the Congress, how you think about term limits. And some people might be surprised to hear this, but I think term limits misses the boat. The conversation around term limits misses the boat because essentially, in my mind, since the seniority system was killed somewhere around the 1960s, when LBJ reformed the way that committee seats could be distributed within the Democratic Party, and then the same thing happened on the right, where Kevin McCarthy and them are the ones who pick who the chairman of a different committee are going to be. The term limits conversation is basically, I'm not going to say it's moot, but it's changed dramatically. Like,
quick thing, Sutter, one point, can you give some context on, give context on why the committee chairmanships mattered back
right
then?
So, so for in context, this is, if this matters a lot whenever it comes to like the civil rights debate, which is that one of the reasons civil rights didn't pass for as long as it did is because the people who controlled the committees within the U.S. Senate had been there the longest. And the reason they'd been there the longest is because they were from one-party, Democratic machine states. And there was literally nothing that they could do in order to dislodge the committee head. Now, it doesn't really work that way anymore in terms of ranking members and more. In some ways, the seniority system has semi-prevailed. But if the Democrats don't want a certain person to be the committee chairman, they can just vote them out. Same thing on the Republican side. They actually have term limits on who can be, you know, speaker, so who can be the head of a different committee, judiciary committee, etc. Famously, they also can kick you off of your committee, Steve King. These things didn't used to be that way. And so I'm curious whether you think still term limits matters, because longevity in Congress doesn't have the same impact that it used to in terms of the distribution of power.
Yeah. Well, we also forget that our founders thought a lot about this. This is one of those issues where I'd suggest not as much has changed as we might assume. And I think there's a lot of people who think maybe the founders just didn't consider that term limits would be needed. It's a complicated issue. And there's a whole lot of sides of it. I ran for Congress in my 20s in a primary against my incumbent. I got 49.2% of the vote. Had I run just a little bit better campaign, I would have put term limits on my guy, right? And so that's one way I look at this, is that the reason I believe ultimately the reason the founders didn't envision term limits being a necessity is that they thought ineffective members, forget committee chairmanships. I think the founders just assumed, you go back to, you know, America in the late 18th century, we were a place where it would have been unthinkable that a lazy, terrible member of Congress would get reelected in perpetuity.
Right.
And so I think in that sense, I would like to see there be a revival of even intra-party competition. It'd be healthy. I don't think we'd solve the problems that a lot of people think we'd solve just by enacting term limits. It's fascinating to me how few people realize that it would require a constitutional amendment. I mean, so there's this conversation always takes me back to the just dearth of civics education.
Yes,
I think so many in our generation still suffer from it. You know, I was in the venture capital industry for a long period of time before kind of dedicating myself to two causes within the political reform and kind of advocating stewardship, as I refer to it. And I'm still blown away at how some of the smartest people in Silicon Valley will offer their opinions on politics without even just a cursory understanding of the Constitution. These are some of the smartest people in America.
Oh, we know.
And I'm just like,
we hear
wow.
It here all the time.
It's fast. It really is. It's both sad and I think enlightening at the same time. So I don't know. Maybe I bounced around your direct question about term limits. I will say this last, because I think this opportunity exists, and I saw it. My mentor politically was Dr. Tom Coburn, the late senator from Oklahoma, who I think was a preeminent conservative of his era, but he was a contrarian and all around good man. And he did the job well. And one of the last examples or most recent examples of an effective citizen legislator. And when he got elected to the House, he committed to serve three terms because he believed term limits mattered. And he left after three terms in 6 years. And another good friend of mine, Reed Ribble from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who was Gallagher's predecessor, did the same thing. Successful business guy, went to Congress for three terms. I think there's virtue in that. I think if members of Congress believe in term limits rather than ranting about them, I saw Madison Cawthorn's tweeting about how, in his first few weeks, he's learned that the cure all is going to be term limits. Well, if he really believes that,
that's not true.
Then he ought to term limit himself. And right. And he would, because I do believe this, and this is a little different than your question, but I believe you endear yourself to voters every time that you make a promise and you fulfill it. And the more unorthodox or hardcore the promise is, the more it matters when you fulfill it. So I you know, you get so many Republicans, it's almost become ubiquitous in Republican congressional politics that you sign one of these meaningless term limit pledges, but none of them actually pledge to limit their own number of terms. I think that would, you know, it could become an expectation. We had an expectation for a long time in this country that you would only serve two terms as president. The expectation enough, you know, gave pressure for people not to stick around forever. But it's not a silver bullet.
Mm-hmm. And the key thing, though, there's a couple of different angles I want to take here. One, I'm glad you brought up the presidential one, because that's where the whole civics and the way the system works dynamic actually matters. So, you know, obviously the presidency doesn't have long-term congressional committee staff. So in the worst case term limit scenario, you would have one where people roll in, they don't know that much about the topic because they've probably been elected or experienced in different areas, and they show up for their two or three terms, and then there's this long-term staff director, or there's this long-term person on the committee on, you know, ways and means, dealing with taxation. There's someone who's focused on the Commerce Committee, dealing with tech regulation, and they say, hey, I've been here since 1996. I helped pass Section 230. Listen to my perspective on this. Like, you actually prevent representatives and senators in some context from gaining the expertise to actually consider their issues. So what I would rather the conversation around term limits focus more on is, how is this actual member performing? So once again, like, we're going to disagree a bit on the, you know, fiscal issues later in the episode, but on a core level, I think if there's a representative or a senator who just owns the fiscal issue beat, even if they disagree with me, and that's the priority of their constituents, you should keep electing that person. If you're a democratic socialist and your number one priority is advancing Medicare for all, you should probably keep electing, and you probably should think that Bernie Sanders is doing a pretty good job of elevating those issues to the heart of the Democratic Party. Putting a term limit on Bernie wouldn't inherently solve that issue. But the question I'll just ask you, because, and this is where your Tennessee experience is useful, I don't know what Tennessee's policy on this is, but we've experimented with term limits on the state level in a variety of different states. So we've run the natural experiment. That's the point of federalism. And if you look at these states where you've had term limits, none of the problems we're actually trying to articulate here, whether it's a lack of expertise, whether it's unresponsiveness, whether it's corruption, have been solved by putting in there. So like, what can we learn from the state efforts around term limits or those sort of topics?
Well, we ought to be able to learn almost everything from the states. I think our way out of the moment of just gross divisiveness and contempt, as Arthur Brooks describes it in American politics, one of our ways out is to redefine, and we may actually have to rebrand federalism. But it, like as Chip Roy, the congressman from Texas, said it in an event that I hosted a couple weeks ago, you know, we got to let California be California and let Texas be Texas and let Tennessee be Tennessee and see the founder's vision for states competing and introducing best models and doing things the right way. I mean, I think states forever, you know, and since the beginning of our country have been experimenting with models with campaign finance. I think one of the most common sense things that happens at a state level, variations of this happen in Tennessee and Texas, where you can't raise money when you're in session. This is common sense. You got this is a little secret, dirty little secret that unless, you know, there's no cameras on and nobody's recording anything, most members of Congress will agree with this. They would love if you could have a ceasefire while they're in session. Once the bells had rung, if there was no fundraising that could take place, of course, you know, it's really unusual. You talk to a member of the Texas State Legislature, Texas State Senate, and they'll be the first to tell you how weird it is to transition into Washington where fundraising is happening around the clock, because it's fairly common across the country that state legislatures bar fundraising activity while they're in session.
Right. So that's interesting, though, because I'm hearing about this for the first time. So this is organic pushback. Doesn't that just advantage your opponent? So let's say you're a member, for example, one of a thing that Joe Biden has always had as a defensive is always, hey, Matt was the poorest member of the Senate. I didn't come for money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If he isn't able to self-finance himself, if he isn't able to raise money, it seems like your opponent is able to raise a lot of money during that period. And as we're seeing, the expenditure on every single campaign is getting higher and higher and higher. So how does that session, how does, and I think it could be different on the state level because you don't have the same national interest going about, but I can easily see a world where you have a, let's say, like middle class or maybe even anxiously upper middle class member of Congress who can't raise during session, who isn't able to raise money from leadership PACs or Citizens United in the ways I'm sure you would support reforming, but then has an opponent who can raise during that period, but then also has out of district or out of state interests that are very much opposed to what they're doing. So how would that part work? Because I feel as if a problem that we've had when it's come to finance and just campaign reforms is in many ways, it's hobbled the ability of people to actually act.
Yeah, I think some of that's fair. I mean, you almost have to think categorically of different types of districts presenting a completely different reelection scenario. Right. I mean, we talk a lot about congressional politics, but the truth is, if you live in a mid-sized market that's a pretty red or pretty blue district, that's a distinctly different model than being one of several congressional districts in an urban environment, let alone a, you know, a single state congressional district. So it all looks and feels different, functions differently. There are such overwhelming advantages to being a member of Congress. I don't know that if you told members of Congress right now, the roughly, and my friend William Timmons in South Carolina points this out a lot. I mean, Congress spends so few full days in session anyway, you'd be taking like 100 days off a 365 day calendar that they wouldn't be able to fundraise. I don't think they'd raise a dollar less. I mean, the money would still come in. You just wouldn't be distracted by it at that period of time. For that matter, you could, there's nothing, you know, if we can change the laws, there's nothing that would prohibit a challenger from not being able to raise money when Congress is in session either, theoretically. Right.
So let's talk about this, because what you mentioned before is that incumbency itself, you know, seems to be one of the biggest problems that we have. You almost have basically no risk once you get elected to Congress. Not no risk, but on the margins, given a variety of factors, fundraising advantage, gerrymandering, etc. You're almost certainly probably going to get reelected unless you screw something up really badly. And there's very little intra-party competition. Leadership PACs play a lot of role in this. You know, the RNC can blacklist consultants from working with challengers. You see a lot of this within the Democratic Party in terms of the progressive left, and Morris is a very much a bipartisan issue. So let's break that down. What are the things that we could change in order to increase competition within parties? Because it seems very difficult for me, from my perspective, because it comes down to the leadership, like you can't, you know, leadership PACs, the way that informal blacklists and all of those things work. Like what could structurally be reformed in order to help reform in that regard?
Yeah. I don't know that there's a clear answer. I mean, there's certainly some people on the left who believe, you know, that you can do fund matching and, you know, you've seen this experiment at a local level. And I think there are probably some examples in cities where you've had non-disastrous outcomes. I'm not convinced that's a solution. I think, interestingly, the revolution that's taking place in small dollar contributions, now it requires catching some lightning in a bottle in order to be the type of candidate, particularly in a primary environment, who can, you know, fund a congressional campaign $20 at a time. But, you know, it has come a long way in a short period of time. And I think that there is a democratization of campaign finance that's underway that we don't fully understand. Yes. And my great hope at the moment, my optimism for ineffective incumbents being challenged within their own party, is that there is more awareness than there's ever been. This is one of the silver linings of the Trump era. More people are paying attention to what's going on in Washington. More people care. There's this palpable interest. There's, I think, a palpable willingness to part with $50 of your own money to help a candidate who you believe in. So I give people all the time, they ask this question about the example of my incumbent who I nearly beat. A lot of people ask me to go run against him. I'm now a father, you know, go do it again. You came so close. So he's a good example. Like, his district is centered in a mid-sized metropolitan area. He's sitting on $2 million. It is a 65-35 red district. So it's not a district that, frankly, it's not a district that's on the, you know, the NRCC or the DCCC's radar. There is, you know, a modest willingness for the NRCC to protect their own. But the big elephant in the room is, how do you go, because members of Congress can they're accumulating money cycle after cycle after cycle. So when I say 2 million, that's a round number, maybe higher than that. That's what he's sitting on. So if I were to announce I'm running tomorrow, which I'm not, I'd be $2 million behind. And in the world that we live in, the way that campaigns function logistically, that's a massive differential to make up. And, you know, maybe there's some plausibility if there's some wedge issues within the party that outside groups would help me, but we could point to only a few examples on either the Republican or Democratic side where powers that be supported a challenger to an incumbent in a primary.
Yeah, I want to underscore something that you said, which is that at the same time, while incumbency is a problem, we actually are seeing a revolution in campaign finance. Like what happened under the Bernie Sanders campaign is the clearest example that you can raise $200 million in small dollar donations. With, you know, in like legitimately small dollar donations. AOC has the, what I believe is the best fundraiser in the House of Representatives and raises every single dollar of that online. And you can also point to Trump, which is, I think, almost half of his money, especially in the early days of the campaign, was coming through small dollar grassroots donations. So populist left and right, regardless of what you think about those people, can actually significantly change the game, which is why whenever I see people calling for regulation of campaign ads on Facebook, I'm like, that is the dumbest thing I've ever seen if you actually care about insurgent politicians, because insurgency actually requires you to be able to connect with your grassroots online. Yeah. But that being said, that's a whole other discussion. What I want to underscore is like, how do we incentivize things more through that way? Because the more that you have to go to the people, so to speak, or, you know, be better, you know, in terms of media, or be better in terms of maybe on the issues, how do we maybe push things more in that direction? And maybe what are the downsides?
Yeah, well, there are some downsides. We're about to feel some of the downsides. I think Kimberly Klasick, the woman who ran in Baltimore, is an example of this. And there's a, you know, growing number of Republican consultants who think that that was effectively, you know, they talk about scam PACs and there's bipartisan support in Congress,
or like the woman
to
who
reform
ran AOC.
Scam PACs, but
the person who ran against AOC. It's like, you don't have a chance in hell.
I think
it's
a guy.
Grifting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
Well, I was going to say, I think there's an argument that it might be worse than grifting, that it could be in effect a scam pain, because there are people making a lot of money when, you know, millions of dollars are raised in a campaign. There's people, especially, you know, the way that the tactics and the kickbacks work with regard to a lot of these small dollar contributions. You know, I think one of the answers to your previous question, also an answer to this one, is that there's been a lot of thought, and there's a lot of Republicans who will say quietly in the confines of their offices that they wish there were some limitation on out of state, if you're a senator, or out of district contributions. Now, you run into some First Amendment issues, but there's some belief that there's probably a compromise that would pass a Supreme Court test, where you could, in effect, have contribution limits that were at one level in district or in state, and at another level out of district. I think that's one of the things I found really interesting running against an incumbent was how many. I think we ran the numbers. I outraised my incumbent 2-1 in the district, but then he ended up outraising me modestly. But it was fueled in a lot of ways by massive contributions from New York City, your big markets. That happens a lot, you know, and that's where the powers that be protect incumbents that have been, friendly. We all understand that's kind of the inside baseball of Washington, and to where seniority certainly behooves you. So there are, in this conversation, if we're willing to go in it with good faith, it's fraught. It's always campaign finance has always been fraught. But if you're willing to go into it with good faith, right now, HR1, I think, undermines, just to be fair, I think it undermines a lot of that good faith, because it
Can
is.
Can you explain why? Because a lot of our left listeners will probably be big fans of HR1.
Yeah, and that's fine. They can be. It is completely partisan legislation. So you look at any landmark legislation that lasts in American history, it's usually not down the line partisan. Republicans, unfortunately, have never had the guts to put forward real comprehensive alternatives to Obamacare, or I think Obamacare would have been in that same category where you would have had a repeal had there been a viable replacement. Obamacare might be an exception to what I'm talking about here. But, you know, massive game-changing legislation needs to be at least modestly bipartisan, and HR1 doesn't even... And I'd say that, you know, to some extent, the framers of HR1 had no intent for it to be. It's got so many partisan poison pills in it. There was never any intent for that legislation to be bipartisan. So your liberal listeners may think it's wonderful. A lot of the people I work with think that it is. I'm a consultant to Issue One, so I don't speak for Issue One, who I do the Swamp Stories podcast in partnership with. And I'm a conservative, and I just say, how am I, even if I agree with, which I do, I agree with several of the planks in HR One. There's some good bills in there. There's actually a couple adaptations, effectively, of bills that we wrote.
What's the broad definition of what HR1 is trying to do?
It is the smorgasbord of democracy reforms, and it does everything from eliminating voter ID to putting voter ID to putting in matching systems for campaign finance. I think it's, if my memory serves me, I think it's a 6-to-1. It would be a 6-to-1 federal matching on fundraising in congressional and Senate races. So, it just really significant structural changes. Now, there are some more modest reforms that I think would clean up this, the dark money wars. This is we've basically gotten to a place where, regardless of your thoughts about dark money, which on the right has been defended for some time, it's become such a unusual arms race that operates clearly outside of the intent of the law, even outside of the intent of Supreme Court rulings, as Scalia explained them. That now none of it makes any sense. And Democrats in 2020, there was 2-to-1 more dark money spending behind Biden than there was Trump. And so now a lot of the arguments that Republicans were using 3 or 4 years ago don't seem to add up. So again, there's some justifiable stuff. There are some components of HR1 that were in bills that were introduced in a bipartisan way by Congressman Gallagher. So again, there's some decent stuff in there. There's some stuff in there that's a total non-starter, even for moderate Republicans. You've got 5 or 6 Brian Fitzpatrick type, real true moderate Republicans, and they're not even willing, as far as I know, to vote for HR1.
Yeah. So for the last bit here, let's go into the other issue they're really focused on. We've hinted at this a couple of times, the Brigger national debt issue. I think I'll give Sagar and my editorial perspective, then we want you to respond. So we're not MMT advocates, but I think something useful about Stephanie Kelton has brought into the debate is the idea that the debate over the federal debt isn't purely just one about economics and finance. It's also one about politics. It's also one about priorities. So it's possible to say that when we say we can't afford to spend more, the real question we should be asking, or is really being stated, is we can't be afford to spend more money on X, Y, and Z thing. So you'll see many people who will say things like, well, the defense budget, which is a priority for Sagar and I, is something we should basically spend money on. But at the other same time, we also think that entitlement programs are not worth spending money on as well, too. So when they say we can't afford to spend more, it's not as if they're actually making a pure statement of economics. They're really describing their priorities. So what makes this debate about the federal debt hard for a lot of people in that political context is it's very hard to take both proponents and opponents of the issue in complete good faith, because what they're really arguing about is what their priorities are. So here's what I'd like to hear here, because we've had people who poo-pooed carrying up the national debt. Can you give a good faith argument for why, especially during a pandemic where more Americans have died than died during World War II, we should be deeply concerned about the national debt in the short term, but also in the long term?
Yeah, I don't know that I'll lean too heavily into the short term. We could define short term. I don't have any opposition, and organizationally, the 501c3 I started, the Millennial Debt Foundation, doesn't have any opposition, ideological or otherwise, to relief spending in a pandemic. I think if anything, it points out the potential perils of crappy fiscal policy leading up to a real catastrophic set of circumstances, which we're in. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways to go, and we don't have a whole lot of time. I understand where you guys are coming from. We probably agree more than we disagree. I'm not a wild austerity guy. I am as peeved as I've sensed that you guys are and have been by the total hypocrisy of Republicans on this issue. My political party is full of crap on this issue and has been for a decade. Now, I come from the Coburn model that was pretty darn consistent And Dr. Coburn was a part of helping us start the organization a couple of years ago. We launched before the pandemic. So a lot of people perceive our efforts as being responsive to what's, you know, soon to be $6 trillion of pandemic-induced borrowing, but it's not. I try to talk, and this is the business guy coming out in me. I watch a lot more CNBC than I do Fox News or CNN. But I watched a little bit of both, and I read a whole lot of stuff, and I still read a lot of kind of business-heavy news. And I find it interesting that there's a lot more concern about the fiscal future of our country and its real-life impact on Main Street, not just Wall Street, but its real, tangible, potential impacts. This is all theoretical. And I think we, on either side of the aisle, there ought to be, and either side of the MMT divide, there ought to be a little bit of humility. Humility is just it's grossly lacking in American politics, but just enough to say, we don't know for sure, because these are all theoretical things. It's got a little bit of climate change to it in that way. A lot of the predictions haven't come exactly true, but there are some principles that seem worth adhering to. And that's where I always come back to, is could some of what we know about sovereign debt have changed in recent years? Sure, that's possible. It could change. Have the laws of gravity changed? I'm less likely to believe that it kind of over the spectrum of civilization, that everything all of a sudden changed when MMT was created. And now all of a sudden, if you print your own currency, you can effectively spend as much as you want in the public domain. And there's a couple points of reference that I always try to stay connected to. One is this, I consider myself a pretty well-traveled person. When I was in the venture capital business, did deals internationally, think a lot about, as I'm sure you guys do, the future of the country. So when we think long-term, 2050 is not some pie in the sky, never land for us. With my fourth kid on the way, that's when I'll probably become a grandfather or so. Okay. So 2050 is when CBO tells us the latest long-term projections show debt to GDP at over 200%. Okay. This is all theoretical. I can acknowledge that, but you'd be hard pressed. You only find fringe economists who believe that's a good place for America to be. Only fringe economists believe that that's good. So that's always worth keeping in mind here. I don't obsess over the soon to be $30 trillion in debt. I obsess over the fact that Washington doesn't put budgets together anymore. We're on a highway to hell, straight from 100% of GDP to 200%. And there's very little willingness, because it's a toxic political environment, to talk about hard things. And you're right, there's sacred cows on both sides. Both sides have their sacred cows. On one side is defense, on one side it's entitlements. Has always been, that's kind of the trope, is that that's the, those are the two zones that can't be touched. And, here's the kind of last couple points. I also think we got to be really careful, because a lot of this also dead ends into privileges we have because the dollar is reserve currency. Okay. Now we're in this Bitcoin moment that I think ought to stoke some skepticism, okay, of what the financial future of the world is. Mm-hmm. But do we really believe, because it's sort of it's the policy attitude of the moment, do we really believe that we Americans are entitled to play by these rules differently than the South Koreans, who are very good stewards of public resources? Do we get to play by different rules than the Germans, who'd gone out of their way to balance budgets before the pandemic? Switzerland, New Zealand, you can kind of go down the list of countries that are run pretty well, that millennials take a lot of interest in. We like to compare notes on the pandemic. Millennials love to compare, what a mess we are compared to these other countries. Well, they also deal with taxpayer money in a fundamentally different way than we've chosen to.
So this is where I have to push back, because can we think that we're different in South Korea? Yeah, we are a global superpower. We have a blue water navy. Like, can we think we're different than Germany? Yeah, they're a regional hegemon at best. We're literally a world superpower. And when it comes to debt to GDP ratio, I mean, Japan has a debt to GDP ratio of 236%, right?
Yeah.
And in reality,
a stagnated economy.
You're right. Fair. Right. But that has much more to do with population than I think that it does necessarily with their economy. So we're talking then about structure internally rather than external. So I think that the question that it comes down to, right, which is that I agree with you. I read this Noah Smith essay, I thought it was excellent, and it was one of the best faith arguments toward this, which is exactly what you're saying, which is like, look, here's the truth. We don't know. We don't know when it becomes a problem. We truly don't. At a certain point, it might become a problem. But I think that we're just not necessarily there. I don't think that the 200% debt to GDP ratio is necessarily the one that we can point to. And more what it is, and I'm curious for your response on this, because I have this argument all the time, is like what you were talking there about Main Street, I believe comes from a misguided inclination that running the economy of the world's number one superpower, or the world's superpower, is in any way analogous to a business. And something, so we had Joe Weisenthal here on the podcast, and something that he said, which I thought was, you know, I thought framed this issue really well, was whenever we're talking about, you know, when the caricature of MMT is like, well, why don't you give everybody like a Tesla, right? And it's like the limiting principle on giving everyone a Tesla is not that you can't afford it. It's that it's literally impossible given the current production mechanism of the Tesla gigabit or whatever factory, right? So when we're arguing again here, and this goes to Marshall's point, it's not necessarily about money. It's about productive capacity. Same thing whenever it comes to trade and more. So it's just, we have to define the terms here importantly around what we're arguing about. So I'd love to hear your response to that.
Oh, yeah. I think I probably agree with a lot of what you said. My reference to Main Street was that this is all theoretical economics. You know, yes, John Arnold, true. The philanthropist, makes the great point that he actually seems to be, and I would agree with this, concerned about the certainty with which those who posit that trillion or $2 trillion deficits will never have consequences. They seem at this point more certain than those of us who are just trying to ask good questions about the fiscal future of the country.
That's fair.
And again, I want my country to be a country of stewards. You know, when Jefferson talked about debt, it may not apply to very sophisticated place and role that America plays in the international economy. But when I made the reference to Main Street, it wasn't to compare the U.S. government to an appliance shop on Main Street. It was just to say that in theoretical economics, you know, the CBO just in the last couple of years has estimated that 200% debt to GDP in 2050 compared to more of 100% debt to GDP could be, again, theoretical, could be worth $6,500 a year to the average working American. Mm-hmm. In adjusted dollars. That's CBO, not me. But again, like they also, you know, CBO also employs people who are a whole lot more educated and smarter than I am. But that's, so that's a theoretical model, but I think it's one worth considering. And when I ask the question about those other countries, it's again to frame this in a macro way where we just ask a question is, does stewardship matter? Are we willing to, does it matter enough? Do the priorities of the federal government matter enough to us? Does putting off nominal adjustments to Medicare matter enough to us to continue carrying out this deficit spending experiment? Because I do believe it's an experiment. And I would just, I ask my sort of MMT friends to meet me in the middle and at least acknowledge this is an experiment. If we were to, you know, back off, it would be an experiment in a sense that it really matters. And we would, you know, we would be getting ahead of potential consequence we haven't felt yet.
So to wrap this, I think we actually are, despite our tribalism, meeting somewhat in the middle here. And I think something that we could all agree on is that whenever there is some form of fiscal rebalancing, because the point of the metaphor about the pandemic is that World War II debt to GDP ratios were out of control. It was worth it, but there was the period in the late 40s and 50s where there was a rebalancing of that effect. Yep. That is going to happen eventually. But that decision of when to do it and how to do it is one that fundamentally relates to trust. Do you trust that your representative is proposing a change to Medicare and Medicaid that's in good faith? How to close this up, Weston, do we effectively get back to that system where that can be done?
Yeah, I do believe we're getting there. And we've entertained conversations with people like Tom Daschle. The Millennial Debt Commission is a business-led commission that we stood up that's now taken briefings from a ton of economists, a dozen prominent senators and House members. And one of the people who gave us a unique perspective is Tom Daschle, who described himself as kind of an old school non-MMT Democrat who used to negotiate ways to kind of keep the country on a good trajectory. I think we're headed there. I sense, because there's so few Democrats who openly adhere to this idea that there is no limiting principle, we can borrow whatever we want to, that it's a bit like a diet, right? I mean, I remember a few years ago, a third kid on the way, getting a little bit of a dad bod. And I went into the mode where I just knew in the back of my head, I got to get in better shape. Used to be an athlete. I got to get in better shape. And what I did for a period of time is I'd tinker with diets. You know, I'd try to do the easy things. And I could get to, you know, a stasis or whatever. Like, I, you know, I could kind of stay around the same weight. But the truth is, I knew kind of in my heart of hearts, I ought to go exercise. I need to just get in good shape. I think that is the case here? Because Democrats know that Social Security needs to be fixed. Democrats know that there's some means testing and other adjustments and maybe some, you know, some competition that could be introduced to Medicare. And these are the big drivers of our long-term deficit situation. So that's why I think we can get back there. And you're right. This is a tough moment for it because we're going through a pandemic. But just because you're in a pandemic doesn't mean you spend 1.9 when the economists say that 1.3 trillion better targeted would have a, you know, more significant impact on recovery.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I can already hear some of our left listeners screaming. They're like, no, they don't. We wish these Democratic senators agreed with us on that. Go ahead.
That's a really good place to end. Like, Weston, thank you so much. This is really great. Everyone be sure to check out Swamp Stories and the podcast, and also check out the Millennial Debt Commission. A lot of really interesting work there, even if you disagree.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
All right, guys, thanks for listening to the episode. We really appreciate it. Please don't forget to subscribe to our Substack, therealignment.substack.com. Leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and share the show with your friends and family. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate it.